This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Cape Horn is a windswept piece of rock at the end of the earth, a bleak and nearly barren island that forms the southernmost tip of South America, a geographic curiosity, except for sailors and armchair adventurers. In the centuries between the days of Sir Francis Drake and the end of the era of the windjammers, Cape Horn marked the passage between the Atlantic and Pacific, the stormiest and most dangerous voyage anywhere on earth. In those days, you weren't a true sailor until you'd been around the Horn. Well, if you've been aboard a ship, or if you've read some of the many stories about the explorers, traders, missionaries, and pirates who sailed those waters, or about the Indians who lived there, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. You can also email us, too. The address is totn@npr.org. Dallas Murphy has been there. He wrote about it in a new book called Rounding the Horn, being the story of Williwaws and Windjammers, Drake, Darwin, murdered missionaries, and naked natives, a deck's eye view of Cape Horn. He joins us now from our bureau in New York, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you much.
I was careful to say that you'd been to Cape Horn and not around it, an important distinction.
It is. We were careful about our usage. We sailed from Ushuaia, Argentina, down to Cape Horn, but we visited Cape Horn. We didn't round it. That had very specific meaning traditionally. It meant a voyage from 50 degrees south latitude around Cape Horn at 55 degrees south latitude and back up to 50 south in the Pacific. That was a distance of, depending on the weather and the sailing, about 1,200 to 1,500 miles.
And depending on the weather, it could take days, weeks, months, and sometimes a lot of people didn't make it.
A lot of people didn't make it. A good time in the windjammer era, which was the very end of the sailing ship life, after the turn of the 20th century, 2 weeks was a good time. If you could consistently get around that from 50 south to 50 south, in 2 weeks you've done very well. Sometimes I wrote about a vessel that took 71 days of constant battering. The storms just didn't relent, and people died, and died of gangrene and overboard and all manner of misery, and they finally made it around. But the record, I think, is 93 days of that.
That's the worst.
That's the worst, I think. The worst one hears about, anyway.
The passage, you can understand why Sir Francis Drake did it. He was off to attack the Spanish on behalf of Queen Elizabeth. You can understand explorers. Darwin and the Beagle explored in those waters. Why did this become such an important commercial passageway?
Well, as you said, it's the only natural break in the Atlantic coastline from the Arctic Circle down to the sub-Antarctic, down to the Strait of Magellan, which is what Magellan discovered and Drake went through when he found the Horn. So it was the only open water passage for big ships. They could get through the Strait of Magellan, but it was too narrow and too shallow and too dangerous. But this was open water south of Cape Horn, about 600 miles down to Antarctica. So they had open water, treacherous weather, but really nothing to hit.
Our number, if you'd like to join our conversation, 800-989-8255. And let's talk with Robin, who's with us from Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
Hello.
Hi.
I wanted to thank you for taking my call. I've actually crossed from South America to Antarctica as a tourist on a Russian research vessel. It's horrible. It's absolutely awful.
What was it like?
Well, you know, you board the ship and you pass through the Beagle Channel, which is how you get out of South America, and it's like glass. It's really smooth. And so you think, oh, I could do this. And that takes, I don't know, until about 11 o'clock at night. And then they kind of make an announcement to secure yourself. And from that point forward, you oscillate through about, I don't know, 45, 50 degrees. The boat just moves back and forth horribly for about 2.5 days until you get to Antarctica. It's incredibly bad.
Was that that Russian?
It's so beautiful, but I was not really prepared for it. People say it's really bad, and then you actually do it, and you think, yes, this is really worse than I thought.
You had a question, Dallas?
Was this the Russian icebreaker that they're using for that, or was that?
Yes, I was on a Russian research vessel, the Professor Molchanovsky.
Right, right.
A small ship, 46 of us were tourists, basically going to see Antarctica. A fantastic experience. It's beautiful and bleak, but I think that crossing the Southern Ocean is not to be taken lightly.
Thanks very much for the call, Robin.
Thank you for taking my call.
Bye-bye. Dallas Murphy, the beginning of your trip, like the beginning of Robin's, was fairly calm. In a way, you almost sounded disappointed that it wasn't as violent as the stuff you'd read about.
A bit. We got very lucky. We had 3 days of 50 degrees and sun. It felt very weird to be slathering on suntan lotion in the Beagle Channel, but our objective was to see the place, and if it was blowing the traditional 50 knots, we would have seen nothing, and we wouldn't have been able to land on the island. The anchorage is very tenuous, and any kind of wind at all, you simply can't stop. And we got lucky. We anchored and went ashore in a dead calm. Reality set in a few days later, and the weather that the lady was talking about, the sleet storms and slashing squalls, came and joined us. But we were very fortunate, and all recognized it.
You describe, you go to great lengths to describe the weather, which is well worth description, by the way, but actually it doesn't rain that much. It just tends to rain horizontally.
Well, that's a remarkable thing, yes. One of the things I didn't know, the annual rainfall is not much more than it is in New York or Boston, but because it's so cold all year round and so windy, there's very little evaporation. So the rain in form of sleet and snow that falls, which is just as likely in summer as winter, doesn't evaporate. And the interiors of these islands, remarkable islands between the Beagle Channel and Cape Horn, the so-called Fuegian Archipelago, magnificently beautiful islands in which in the center there is no life at all. There's only one kind of tree that can survive down there, but there were no birds, no bugs, not even bugs under rocks. And that was one of the things we wanted to find out, is how come the seas were rich in life? How come the islands were so lifeless in the interiors? And there's a kind of elegant explanation. It's not that the temperatures are extreme in themselves, and it's not the extreme cold, but it's the prolonged absence of warmth. It just never warms up. And so the moisture just stays there, and nothing can take hold, nothing at all.
Hmm. An email from Stuart Clipper. In 1987, I had the distinction of rounding the horn 8 times in one day, using his definition, not yours, Dallas. I was crewing on a yacht that was completing a sailing expedition to the Antarctic. The wind heading being what it was, we had to tack 8 times before anchoring in the bay near the Met Station on Cape Horn Island. Two of us, not me, headed out to hike to the tip of the Cape. They were instantly called back and were immediately and emphatically told to retrace their steps. 2/3 of the island was mined, a holdover from the Chilean argument with Argentina about border and sovereignty issues in Tierra del Fuego. The two being Irish and Norwegian, couldn't read the Spanish warning sign. The Chilean Navy awarded us an official certificate citing our having rounded the horn. So, and he has a question, but that's true about the mines, isn't it?
It is, I'm afraid. Argentina and Chile aren't fond of one another, and the border is the Beagle Channel. And most of Tierra del Fuego is Chilean, but part of it is Argentinian, and Cape Horn is in Chile. The Chileans, for a long time, had been closing off huge sections of this wilderness because they feared marine invasion by Argentina. And I discovered this when I started planning the itinerary. I was trying to plan it, making sense using the west winds. Mm-hmm. I found out I couldn't go half the places I wanted to because the Chileans had closed it off. And I got sort of lucky. I found someone who knew someone who was willing to talk to the Chilean naval attaché in Washington. And by sort of luck, that had been tried before to no avail, but by luck and a kind of internecine squabble in the Chilean Navy, I got permission to go to these places. And that was thrilling and made us feel very important. And
much to the astonishment of some of your companions, I have to say.
Much to their astonishment, old hands who had been down there for a long time, including the owner of the boat, one Skip Novak, hadn't been there in 15 years of trying. And we got in and saw places that, because the Chileans have been so protective, is pristine.
Dallas Murphy is the author of Rounding the Horn. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And there was a question at the bottom of Stuart Clipper's email. On which ear did sailors place an earring to signify their having rounded the horn under sail?
I've heard both things. I've heard left and right. And I'm not sure. There are other things, too. Some of them we shouldn't go into, probably. But but there was the earring, and there were other signs that one had been around the horn. It was a true distinction. And there were Cape Horn sailors and the other kind of sailors.
Let's talk now with Frank, who's on the line with us from San Francisco.
Good morning, Neil. I was an officer on the old Matson liner Lurline in 1969, when we made a trip around South America, leaving from San Francisco down the West Coast and back up through the canal. And we left from Punta Arenas, Chile, into the Straits of Magellan. And we had a very nice passage. The weather was beautiful. The place was arid, as your guest says. The highlight of our trip was there was an old Moore McCormick freighter, a C-3, that had come to grief and gone aground on a rocky outcropping with its stern up on the bank and the bow up to the house underwater. And the Chilean pilots told us that the ship was filled with corned beef, and at some point the Tierra del Fuego Indians were going to take the critical case of corned beef out of the after hold, and this thing was going to tip straight up and slip down into the depths. And we found that very interesting. And as far as the Chilean and Argentinian relationship, we were supposed to make our first stop that in Punta
Arenas?
No, not Punta Arenas, but in Montevideo, Uruguay. And the Chilean pilots were going to get off. We also had Argentinian pilots. But because of an engine problem, we went right into Buenos Aires. And BA, or Argentina, would not allow these Chilean pilots to get off the ship. They had to go to Brazil with us. So that was my experience.
Well, yeah. Go ahead, Dallas.
Well, every day we had to call in to the Chileans at various points to tell them where we were and what our plans were for the next day. And if you didn't call, or if you couldn't get through because of the mountains interfering with the signal, they called all the time. They constantly called to just make sure you were doing what you said you were going to do. They're very serious about it. As for the mines, I know from sources that there were mines there in the 80s. Whether they're there now, I don't know. I didn't want to know. But one hears that there are, and that you cannot walk on the toward the horn itself. In a way, that's fitting because it should be seen from the water to its best effect. You can't really see it from the land.
Frank, thanks very much for the call.
Good program. I enjoy every bit of it.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
There's a little wooden house near Cape Horn, which you visited, Dallas Murphy, and there's a beautiful poem on a plaque at the foot of the hill, which you translate this way. It's written by Sarah Vile. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. I am the albatross that waits for you at the end of the world. I'm the forgotten soul of the dead sailors lost, rounding the horn from all the seas in the world. But they did not die in the wild seas. Today, they fly on my wings towards eternity in the high cry of the Antarctic winds.
I found that deeply moving, standing at the foot of that monument on this place. It's wonderful.
It's an albatross itself, the monument.
It's enormous, yes. It's an albatross cut in negative space in this huge piece of plate steel square standing on the corner, on its corner. So it looks like an albatross banking. But you see the clouds passing behind the albatross, and it looks like it's moving. And there has to be a monument at Cape Horn, and the one they made is a credit to the Chileans, that's for sure. Since we're saying these things about the Chileans now, they should be congratulated on that monument.
The description, the poem, and much more is in Dallas Murphy's new book, Rounding the Horn. Dallas Murphy joined us from our bureau in New York. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.